It is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David joins us on a Friday morning. We rebroadcast it on the weekend and early next week. David has his own website, themediabeat.us. You can find him also posting on the Huffington Post. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. Good morning, David.
Well, good morning to you. It's good to be with you. And it's nice to know that I appear at your end of the green dot on your console. That's very pleasing.
Whenever I see
green
a sign.
For go.
Whenever you see that sign. That's right. That's exactly right. Whenever you see that solid green dot, you know you're okay. Well, I don't know where you are and where you're broadcasting from, and I don't know how connected you are this morning to the news, but just to let you know that Roger Stone was arrested this morning in Florida.
Yes, that news did filter through to me. I'm in fact, here's a little pop quiz for you. I'm overseas, but not abroad.
You're overseas, but not abroad. So I would have to say Hawaii.
Close. Well, close in concept, very far away geographically. I'm much closer. I'm Puerto Rico.
All right.
I'm in a United States territory, but I'm not obviously in the contiguous 48. So I'm overseas, but not abroad. And I carefully placed myself on my reporter's traveling desk right by the beach. I hope you can hear the crashing waves coming in. Yesterday they were 12 feet high. It was surfers paradise. I'm on the western end of Puerto Rico, around the beaches of Rincon. But this morning, another aspect of Puerto Rico's soundscape came very much alive for me as I set up to talk to you. You may also hear the sound of a power drill. That's another very typical sound of Puerto Rico, along with ebullient music almost everywhere you go. You also hear the sounds of reconstruction after, this is, in this case, after Hurricane Maria. The whole island, as you know, was decimated badly and is still in the process of recovery. A lot of reconstruction going on.
All right. Every once in a while we get a little cut out, but it's not too bad. But I do hear that drill in the background. So now are you in Puerto Rico to do some reporting and to gather some information, or just maybe trying to have a little bit of fun in your life?
Well, I'm attempting to do both, and quite often it is perfectly possible to do that. I'm happy to report.
Okay. Now, how long have you been in Puerto Rico?
I've been here almost a week now. I'll be back with you in the mainland United States in time for next week's broadcast, though.
Now, since you've been there a week and where you've traveled, give us now this is great because we can get an honest eyes on look at how Puerto Rico is recovering, and maybe if you've spoken to any Puerto Ricans about the recovery, about the president, the way things are being handled.
The president is not the most popular man. And in this island, I gather. Let's put it this way. The mayor of San Juan, the capital, is making great capital out of the fact that she is possibly the most forceful opponent of Donald Trump on the island. And there's much to go for in terms of Trump abating, as it were. You'll remember, of course, that he didn't seem to even recognize that Puerto Ricans were United States citizens early on in his own presidency as part of his reaction to the disaster that was Hurricane Maria. And also that footage, which has gone viral just about everywhere, but is especially remembered here in Puerto Rico when he was handing out kitchen paper towel, lobbing them into the crowd as if he was shooting hoops. He was obviously having great fun, but there was something of a mismatch between his levity and the seriousness of the situation, where people were short of every conceivable kind of product that might aid their recovery, including the basic things like household cleanliness and the rest of it. As I say, he's just not popular in any sense here, regardless of your position on the traditional political spectrum. The information keeps flowing. Just recently, the Washington Post revealed that back in September, President Trump tried to put a block on her recovery funding from federal funds on the grounds that he got it into his head that Puerto Rico was using the federal emergency funds to pay off its massive debt. You'll probably know, of course, that Puerto Rico suffers economically terribly. It's in a most appalling debt situation, and there's a congressional appointed federal overseeing mechanism for their economy now, and the recovery from that, which is long term, is a tough struggle facing them, and it's all been worsened, of course, by all the hurricane damage.
Well, that's the whole thing. I mean, the economic structure in Puerto Rico was bad, to say the least. And after just a massive once-in-a-100-year hurricane, recovery, it was simply, and this is what everybody understood, simply impossible by Puerto Rico itself. I mean, nothing more than a full-fledged effort by the United States of America, it was going to bring Puerto Rico out of where it was.
Well, absolutely, and Puerto Ricans are American citizens, yeah. And federal funds were the appropriate way of doing it. It would be the same it is the same. That's the whole point. It's the same in any state of emergency, presidential state of emergency. If there were a hurricane in Texas, Alabama, Mississippi, wherever, here, of course, Puerto Rico, if it were a state, and that's a whole other argument about its peculiar status in regard to the rest of the United States proper. But if it were a state, it would be the poorest state in the Union, of course, poorer even than Alabama or Mississippi.
Now, unfortunately, had they had a Trump Tower, I'm sure support would have come much quicker.
that's very funny. They only had to rebuild.
The one thing you can be pretty sure of is that despite all the hotel development that there has been in Puerto Rico, tourism being its most important industry, I think I can pretty well guarantee you there is no head of steam here for a Trump Tower.
Well, I believe that they did. That they voted for Mrs. Clinton anyway, right?
They did. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So, quick. While we are, shall we say, what did you call it? Abroad, but not. Overseas, but not abroad.
That's correct.
Could you turn your attentions just a tad further south?
To Venezuela, perhaps.
Yeah.
I'm in that part of the hemisphere.
Exactly.
The same part of the hemisphere. That's true.
And what you said, and this people have a terrible time conceiving of this here in New England, for example, or even the media capital of the world. But what you said about the sound of construction and the music and the this and the that, and it's a different. You cannot transpose exactly. The energy. And as a matter of fact, I currently have a friend living in Mexico City, and two people from New York happened to go down there. The friend was elsewhere, and they noticed, again, there's a dynamic of a, and this happens when there are masses of people without masses of resources.
Well, that's true. I mean, I as you know, I spent most of my working life as a journalist reporting on what we once called the Third World. I know historically what we meant by that. There were two big power blocks, communism and the capitalist West, and the Third World was somehow thought of as a nebulous other. So we gave it the number three. But I think the kindest word, generally speaking, is the developing world. And yes, when resources are low, but needs are great, there is a human resilience that comes forth in these multiple soundscapes. I think you, as radio people, will appreciate this most of all. Go out and about. In any developing country, and you can sometimes be overwhelmed, or aurally and auditorily, by the energy in play. You're right.
And with that, again, going a little bit further south, I'm just curious what you would say about what's going on in Venezuela. Amnesty.
Well, Caracas is a place. Sorry. I'm sorry, I'm British.
The drill just really...
I know.
It's fine. But Caracas, yeah.
When I was working in... I have worked in Caracas before, and the capital of Venezuela. And there is a great propensity, as in many places, for the popular voice to be expressed popularly, quite literally, on the streets. And that's happening again now with the head of the National Assembly having to, it's a whim, by the way, it's a constitutional procedure that he's following as the head of the National Assembly, and in opposition to the president, who has made such a mess of the country, a corrupt mess of the country, following in, you know, something of a long tradition, I'm afraid, and creating the kind of ill feeling that is inevitably bound to lead to upheaval and revolt. In this case, as I say, a constitutionally framed revolt. And of course, now there is a contest between them. The president holding on for the moment, at least, to the main instrument of power, which in Venezuela is the military. A well-respected institution in large part. Not sure that it deserves that respect, but it is well-respected across many sections of the community. And, of course, it's vital to the maintenance of the president's power. For, as I say, for the moment, he's holding on to it. However, coming in on the side of the National Assembly leader, are bigger forces from outside the country, not least of all the Trump administration. And many people, of course, are questioning why that support is so automatic. I think it's just in the sense that they're, in some ways, they're on the side of a populist movement that is not right wing.
Right, I was
just... So. And the only possible explanation for the Trump siding on the if you like, the in large part leftist popular uprising at the moment is that old bugbear Venezuela's communism. At least there's one thing that Trump and the rest of the Republicans can agree on, is that they're anti-communist.
Well, one of the things that I found striking was how it was, if you will, rolled out, because you had what used to be referred to as OAS countries, but then you had Justin Trudeau.
The Organization of American States, yes.
And then you had Justin Trudeau, and only after that, you know, one of the things that you, if you pay attention to this sort of thing, notice is how America likes to be first, and it's like, well, we did this. They might do something with a bunch of other people, but they want to announce that they did it first.
And ideally, large. in these days, they would want to be not only first but alone.
So,
which seems
so
contrary to what most international thinking goes.
But so given that is at least the apparency, it is somewhat striking that didn't happen in this instance. At least from my warped...
I'm not sure that Venezuela was very high on the administration's order of priorities, and I'm not sure they reacted with it with the sort of alacrity that a world leader might want to.
Right.
But now they're very firmly in the mix. I mean, it's very clear that... it gets into one of those silly arguments which is common in old-fashioned realpolitik pushes from the American side. The country has declared its Americans persona non grata here, or at least the president has, the Venezuelan president has, Maduro. And And of course, America is refusing to be declared non grata because we America are backing the National Assembly chief, so we cannot be thrown out. On the other hand, you know, sensibly enough, the State Department is evacuating all but essential personnel on pure safety grounds, wisely, I believe.
And so the other thing that is always difficult in these instances is this: there has been just miserable, dreadful privation going on for years.
Sure. And rampant inflation and the most appalling lack of the simple mainstays of
basic resources, and you don't even want
to going to the store going to the store to get the basic essentials, and they're simply not being there, or you have to stand online for two, three hours before you get them. It's a pattern of life that we're all too familiar with in many parts of the world.
And yet, you know, with all due respect, it's sort of tedious to watch on your evening news. So every so often, you know, some sort of lip service is paid to it, and then off you go about, let's just say, more sexier things. And so it appears that something comes out of the clear blue when, in fact, you know, it's a powder keg that's been just waiting.
Sure. For a lot of newsrooms, this came as a surprise. And newsrooms are generally resilient enough to respond to things as if they knew they were coming all along. Sometimes not, of course, and people can be bowled over entirely. But certainly Venezuela was simmering on the point of boiling over for a long time. And anyone who wants to keep resources on, journalistic resources on hand, ready to be capable of a quick response, then they should have been watching. And of course, the best newsrooms were. I mean, I think some of the American media organizations that look carefully at Latin America were certainly not taken by surprise by this.
And anything else that you are focused on aside from,
I'm attempting a broad scan at the moment. I mean, this is, in large part, as I was saying to Marshall, in large part, this is a break.
You're alive.
I'm not working full time here.
It would
by
be
any means. I'm glad to.
and it is only with a break that one gets better perspective. So that's.
But it's nice to get real. It's nice to get trusted eyes on a situation that we hear so much about now, off and on in the media. It's nice to get, you know, a firsthand look at Puerto Rico and what it's like now and how it's adapting and how it's rebuilding.
It is being rebuilt. Well, since you're there in Puerto Rico and on half break, what do you say about your original, your country of origin?
My own dear old original home country.
Blighty.
United Kingdom is it's stuck in this awful spiral in which no one seems to know how to get out of it. I mean, we go back to the basic question again and again and again. When a majority, not a particularly overwhelming majority, but a substantial majority of the British public, when asked in a popular vote, a referendum, whether they wanted to leave Europe, said that we want to leave Europe. But it's becoming clearer and clearer that people had no idea what leaving Europe meant. And now that it's becoming all too clear and all too complicated, there is one definite thing you can say about the British political scene. There is no consensus in any realm of the political spectrum. Any part of that political spectrum, do you get the sense of the makings of a consensus about quite what to do about Brexit? And we keep running into that terrible morass of non-consensus. Nobody knows how to reach agreement on this. And here we are with March 29th rapidly appearing on the horizon. Perhaps even closer than that now.
It's about 8 weeks.
Only a matter of weeks before the deadline day is reached, and we're supposed to be out of Europe because that's what we said we wanted.
Well, I've got I have to say something to you, David. You picked two horrible countries to become two mixed up countries, not horrible, but two countries that are mixed up to become residents of.
No, it's
oh my God.
I'm sorry. I take issue with that.
In my own defense, Marshall, I'm going to have to say, like a lot of people, how was I to know?
That's right.
And like a lot of people,
British
people
are feeling that at the moment. How were we to know this was how it would turn out?
But this is part of my what did you think was going to happen when you put all the, and I'm not saying that to you per se, but I,
well, you're right. It goes back like it does for so many Americans too about a different issue, but it goes back to 2016. The campaigns on both sides of the argument about leaving Europe during the Brexit referendum were not paragons of clarity at all.
I think
the predictions of people, on one side more than the other, I am convinced as a journalist who tries to get at the bottom of these things, that the case presented on the Brexit side was totally baseless. All sorts of manufactured facts, not facts, manufactured notions were thrown at the British public and proved the basis for a really foolish vote.
Well, and it's stuck in it. The same thing happened in this country.
But the
and the same thing has happened in other countries.
It's arguable that it's the same process, yeah.
And it's arguable that it's happening elsewhere. The situation is that when the media is used as a tool to make your argument, and when it's divided in that way, so you listen to this, and it becomes rather a sporting event rather than a source of cogent information.
Yeah.
And that is
that constant
criminal,
split
in
the journalistic world about whether we should be covering what is loosely called the horse race as opposed to, with a capital I, the issues. And here we are showing the price to be paid for only, or at least substantially only, in large part, predominantly reporting the horse race at the expense of the issues, we end up with the mess that we're in.
Well, being someone who knows just a little bit about the horse race, I can assure you that the race is over in a much shorter period of time, and you wait 6 weeks or thereabouts, maybe less. And, watching someone handicap a race is kind of hilarious because they've got all this information, but it's in a vacuum because it's only what happened before and therefore what should happen. But it's got nothing to do with what's actually going to happen because no one is able to sit down and talk to each of the horses and say, hey, bud, how you feeling this morning? Or hey, sweetheart.
That's an interesting analogy to frame it in. That's interesting. We have no precedent for this eventuality. It's very hard to predict how it would go. On the other hand, it's an economic mechanism of the European Union, and the British economy is pretty well established in its shape. There were lots of ways of making some cold-headed economic predictions. And of course, in the end, it boiled down to who you believed and who was better at casing the arguments. The truth is, though, that underlying it all, and I think this also applies to the 2016 experience for America electorally, underlying it all were not economic arguments at all. A lot of it was sheer emotion, and a lot of it was those base feelings of fear of change and fear of the foreigner, the distant, the different, the other. And that, in the end, was the reason why we had the Brexit result. It was never an economic argument anyway.
The pictures we will remember out of 2016 and the election and Brexit are the big red bus and the wall. Really? That big red, simplistic
symbolism.
Yeah. But that's, you know, welcome to a combination of media and social media.
Absolutely.
What could be better?
I have to agree with you.
Well, in that case, let's end the show. Thank you very much. David Tereshchuk.
Thank you from Puerto Rico.
The Media Beat.
David Tereshchuk from Puerto Rico. And as soon as that drill stopped, the interruptions stopped as well.
Right, which is probably, I'm sure they weren't drilling.
It was just a drill, what the heck. But David was in Puerto Rico live. And, of course, the Media Beat can be heard not only on air, but online, robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on the Media Beat with David Tereshchuk.